Thank you. Thank you for having me, and you can never be too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Today, Rabbi's guest is Neil Friedman, CEO of Menemsha Films and a driving force behind Kai Flicks, the streaming platform bringing outstanding Jewish movies, documentaries, and television series to audiences around the world. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Well, here in Tucson, Arizona, in the Sonoran Desert, it's hot. Really hot now. Officially, summer starts today. So on the longest sunlit day of the year, yeah, it's hot. And so it must be time to play the immortally, eternally entertaining cut from the late great comedian Alan Sherman about kids going off to summer camp. Here it is, our annual tradition on Too Jewish for the past, oh my goodness, 23 years, believe it or not. It's the classic tune, the summer camp tune.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner? He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators, and the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh mother father, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest father, darling mother, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball, gee, that's better. Mata fada, kindly disregard this letter.
There's something about summer camp that never changes. While Alan Sherman wasn't talking about Jewish summer camp per se, which is one of the best ways to try to make sure your children and grandchildren stay Jewish, he is describing an experience that so many of us have had. Leaving home for cooler climates, different customs and traditions, with a bunch of kids we never met before. And that homesickness he describes with great humor can be a very real thing. One that most all of us overcame and had a great time at camp, whether for a week or a summer or every summer of our youth. It's also time for vacation now. Some of us are heading out to enjoy the wide world outside of our hot home cities and towns. One of the great unsuspected pleasures of traveling is the chance to explore Jewish sites. and living Jewish communities in far-flung places, something we've always advocated for on Too Jewish. I can assure you that we Jews have lived pretty much everywhere on the planet and have active synagogues in places you might never imagine we would have them. It's always worthwhile and often surprisingly gratifying to go and find communities, Jewish communities, to pray with, to meet people, to see the remarkable places we Jews have created in the far corners of the world. You can find Jewish places almost everywhere you go. Well, maybe not Antarctica or Laos or Fiji, but almost everywhere. So look up Jewish travel online and just make sure that you email or call ahead if you're going to temple on a Friday. In today's world, many of the places around the world require advance information on who is coming for security reasons. Today is, Father's Day. Clearly a Hallmark faux festival, if ever one existed, and a great excuse to sell barbecue grills. But speaking as the father of four children, it is important to recognize dads. So, here on Too Jewish is a classic Yiddish song dedicated to Dad. This is a pop jazz version of Oh Mein Papa, a song Eddie Fisher made famous a very long time ago, this time sung by the wonderful Yiddish interpreter and past guest of Too Jewish, Eleanor Risa.
Oh.
Yiddish classic. Oh my papa. Fathers are important figures in all cultures, of course, but for Jews, the concept of the father has extra importance. For example, the beginning of the central prayer in every Jewish service is called the Avot, literally the prayer for the fathers, and it includes a text that praised God for being the God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. From the time of the Talmud, at least 1,600 years ago, every Jewish prayer service has included this central evocation of the fathers. Fathers are given special honors in other ways in Judaism, too. The Ten Commandments focus on honoring father and mother, and the Gemara spends time debating whether the honor due your father is greater than the honor due your rabbi or teacher. I remember raising that question at a synagogue retreat some years ago about ethics, explaining that teachers, including but not limited to rabbis, are supposed to be shown great honor at all times, and so are fathers. So, whom should you honor more, your father or your rabbi? My then 7-year-old son, he's the one who just turned 30, Boaz, raised his hand. I called on him for his analysis of this complex ethical question. He asked, "What if your father is also your rabbi?" Which pretty much ended that discussion. Everybody laughed. You know, we hear a lot about Jewish mothers in our culture, but not as much about Jewish fathers. Perhaps that's a mistake. You know the famous joke? A boy comes home from school and says, "Mom, I was cast in the school play." "What's your role?" she asks. "I'm the Jewish father," he answers. Mother snaps, "You go back and tell the teacher you want a speaking part." That's not really how it works. Fathers play a central role, teaching both sons and daughters about Judaism and ethics, making the great traditions of our people meaningful and fresh in this and every generation. It's both the place of the father and his responsibility. And that's an important part in any and every family, every mishpacha. So, happy Father's Day. And may all you fathers out there get just what you want from your kids today, which for most of us is not a tangible gift at all. It is the love of our children, and at least most of the time, their respect. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Neil Friedman, the CEO of Menemsha Films, which makes Jewish movies, and the excellent streaming platform HiFlix, which makes Jewish films and TV series available to everybody. It's a great platform. Learn all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
America was conceived in liberty, dedicated to the notion that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights. To preserve them, we gather to read and reaffirm the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 8:30 a.m. at Udall Park, under the Tree of Liberty in front of the Rec Center, to read the Declaration together. On our 250th anniversary, let us be one nation, July 4th, 8:30 a.m. at Udall Park.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Neil Friedman is the CEO and founder of Menemsha Films and the streaming platform HiFlix, a way to see Jewish movies that you didn't know existed, and many of which are really extraordinary. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
So tell us about the origin story, the genesis, the Bereishit story of Menemsha Films.
I'm originally a lawyer by profession.
We forgive you. It's okay.
Okay. I practiced corporate law in New York and Park Avenue, and then I became an entertainment lawyer. And then I was hired away by film companies to run their business affairs and be their chief operating officers. And I got invited, asked to come out to California in 1988 to be part of TriStar Pictures and run the be chief operating officer of one of the divisions of TriStar. And from there, I ran a company for 6.5 years called Ed Pressman Films. It was the leading independent producer of films in the 90s. After that, I became co-head of the independent film division of William Morris. So I've done everything there is to do.
Boy, you really have. That's quite a record in the industry.
So I thought it was time after that I ought to use all those tools to start my own company, and that's when Menemsha started in 1998. And we were very lucky. The first 5 years, we had an Oscar-nominated film each of the first 5 years. So we got off to a very successful start.
Really,
but I had a young daughter that was growing older, up. Not older, but up, growing up. And instead of being a sales international sales company handling films worldwide, we switched over to being a U.S. and Canadian art house film distributor in 2003. In 2004, we got very lucky with a film called Gloomy Sunday that did $1.5 million. And then in 2012, we decided to become exclusively a distributor of Jewish-themed films. And we've been doing that ever since at Menemsha. And Chiflix came about as a result of three films in a row for us where we did over $1 million. And Netflix licensed the first two, but not the third, only because they had evolved to so much of doing their own original programming. And I said to myself, this is before the pandemic in 2019, that, and this is a wonderful film called 1945 from Hungary, maybe the best film we've ever distributed in terms of quality and from an artistic point of view, that we needed to control our own destiny, and therefore we said we're going to start our own SVOD service, Chiflix, in 2019. And 2020, when the COVID hit, we immediately went up with 50 of the Menemsha titles and started Chiflix.
The range of films available on Chiflix is extraordinary. If you were to be asked how many Jewish films of quality are made every year, what could you answer?
I would say 250.
Wow.
And my job for Menemsha or Chiflix, and I have the same responsibility with both, is to curate from those large number of available programs to find the films and the TV series, because Chiflix is driven subscription-wise by TV binge-watching, to pick what I believe to be the best available films and or TV series each year. I want to emphasize to you and the audience, Rabbi, that we're a diaspora Jewish distribution company, not an Israeli, and only because we want to make a distinction that we're interested in culture from all parts of the world and storytelling from all parts of the world. It so happens that we distribute a lot of Israeli films and especially handle a lot of TV series from Israel on Chiflix that are our most viewed programs on Chiflix.
And we will talk much more about that about the origins of all these films with Neil Friedman when we come back in a moment right here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established 7.5 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services Friday night, 6:30 p.m. in air-conditioned comfort, always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah study at 9 a.m., services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. And there's always bagels and lox for Torah study and Kiddush afterwards for everybody. Come, if you can't do it in person, on Facebook Live. Go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests always. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious School is taking registrations now for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our wonderful Torah Tikes experience for the youngest kids, as well as Hebrew School, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Confirmation, and Teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everybody. You can come to services in person or on our Facebook page, and come to classes in person or on Zoom. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available live and on Zoom. All of that's available through our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, outreach, life cycle events, everything. All of our courses are taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes stores, very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You've had so much international experience, a fair amount of it in Africa, although not most of your diplomatic stuff in North Africa. But, you know, the Moroccan Jewish community, which we've talked about here on 2Jewish before, fascinating. It was huge and important for a long time. It's now quite small. But that wasn't true when the Nazis arrived in the time of, say the movie Casablanca setting.
Right.
A very unique circumstance there. Tell us about it, would you?
Absolutely. So Morocco has had a series of rather remarkable kings, Mohammed V, Mohammed VI, and the fifth was back in colonial days when Morocco was technically a French protectorate, not a colony, but it was part of France. However, recognizing the potential for conflict, the French recognized the Moroccan king as the guy who would carry out their decrees, if not make the decrees himself. So when France fell and the Vichy government took over, it took over in all the French colonies of North Africa, which was to say Tunisia, Algeria, by far the biggest, and Morocco, probably the largest Jewish population of the three. But they all had, you know, important ancient Jewish communities. And in other French colonies in North Africa, Jews were deported under the Nazis, or their property was confiscated, or both. In Morocco, that didn't happen, because when the French administration handed the king an order to compile a census of Jews and of Jewish property, the king responded very simply, clearly, and defiantly, "There are no Jews in Morocco. They are only my subjects." And in today's world, it's almost unimaginable that an Arab leader would take a position like that. But you look at this guy who was beloved by all his subjects, Jewish and otherwise, even though he never got recognition from like Yad Vashem as a righteous among the Gentiles, he certainly got a lot of recognition and affection and loyalty from Moroccan Jewry. And Moroccan Jews didn't even begin to emigrate in massive numbers until 1956, which is Suez Canal campaign and a kind of realignment of the Arab world more militantly against Israel than it had been before. And then something else happened that was internal to Moroccan Jewry, but in 1960, virtually every Jew who could left Morocco. Now that, as you pointed out earlier, there are still communities of Jews all through Morocco, functioning synagogues, functioning cemeteries. So Casablanca is in some ways like Chicago of Morocco. It's not a political capital. It might be the most populous city, but it is the commercial capital for sure. It's a port. It has a large Jewish community. It has the only Jewish museum in the Arab world. And it wasn't even one of the so-called royal cities, where there were royal palaces where the king rotated throughout the year, depending on the weather and the climate, among his many palaces scattered all over Morocco. Those cities are all worth a visit. They all still have Jewish communities to one degree or another, but in some cases it's, you know, like 50 or 150. Casablanca is the one that numbers in thousands and thousands.
It's still an interesting community. They had it when I was last there, which is a while back. They still had a Jewish community center. They still had a preschool, actually.
Yeah. And in some ways, the community gets rejuvenated by frequent visits from Israelis of Moroccan origin.
Oh, yeah.
Who have a strong tradition of going to Morocco for all of Pesach and spending the whole 8 days there in hotels that are kosher, like luxury hotels, 5-star, 6-star hotels, but they're completely kosher le Pesach for the huge wave of Israeli tourists that comes around that time.
So I want to note, you know, just to remember that if it wasn't for the King of Morocco, who knows how many of that, what percentage of that population would have survived, because the Nazis were really in control.
Right.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Now, if you don't already know, a mensch is a good person, a solid, decent, ethical human being. Izzy and Howard are brothers, hated by the whole community. They run a crooked business. They lie, they cheat the poor, but they are also very, very wealthy. When Izzy dies, Howard goes to Rabbi Bloom and says, "I will donate $1 million to your synagogue if at the funeral you say my brother Izzy was a mensch." The rabbi thinks long and hard, but eventually agrees. When it comes time for the funeral, the rabbi recounts Izzy's wrongdoings at great length during his eulogy. And then he concludes with a sentence, "But compared to his brother, he was a mensch." Now that's a clever eulogy. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we have an unusual pairing of Torah portions. They are called Chukat and Balak. In general, we have more Torah portions than weeks of the year, so sometimes we have to double up. This particular Jewish year is short in the area of Shabbats when we can read portions, and therefore we are gifted with some doubled portions. And this week's portion, Chukat Balak, occurs only in the diaspora, that is, Jewish communities outside of Israel, only for conservative and Orthodox congregations generally, and only rarely. So what's so unusual about combining these two Torah portions? Well, usually when sections are combined, they are on a similar theme or subject, and it sort of makes sense. But Chukat Balak, this rarest of all doubled Torah portions, deals with two quite different subjects. The first, Chukat, has to do with purification, an odd ritual associated with the red heifer. The second portion, Balak, has to do with how others see us, a famous talking donkey, not the one from Shrek, and a glimpse into how differently we can look to others from afar. Where's the connection? Well, maybe it's this. Both portions revolve around a four-legged creature that is essential to the text, one in the form of a cleansing ritual, one crucial to the narrative. Secondly, both portions highlight the uniqueness of our particular people of Israel, given a special responsibility to seek to achieve lives of ethical goodness and holiness. In Chukat, we're given specific commands allowing us to cleanse ourselves from sin. In Balak, we see that no matter how we view ourselves, others can still see us as a powerful force in the world. As a unique people, Israel, we have God's command to seek to make the world a better, holier, more ethical place. That is a great set of responsibilities indeed. Not a bad message this week of the doubled Torah portions, or any week. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest, Neil Friedman, explains why he has the best job in the world picking films and TV series to make available on the Jewish streaming service HiFlix. Find out how he started Menemsha Films and how to access all that great content when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Okay, so now there's actually some sort of a deal to end the U.S.-Iranian war standoff and to open up the Strait of Hormuz again to oil shipments. But just what does this deal really consist of now that it's been signed online by President Trump, Vice President Vance, and the current leaders of Iran? Well, according to the latest information, and details of this agreement have been leaking out in bits and pieces like shrapnel from a ballistic missile from Iran shot down by the David sling, Iran will retain its ballistic missiles, but will supposedly never be allowed to have nuclear weapons. At least that's what the current U.S. President, Donald Trump, said last week, stressing his deal opening the Strait of Hormuz and ending the war with the Islamic Republic will save Israel from atomic destruction. And we know that everything President Trump says is always true, right? Think of what Israel's getting. They're not going to be nuked, Trump told reporters in Evian, France, toward the end of the G7 summit, where he secured the support of its leaders for the deal that relies on a carrot-and-stick sort of approach. Trump offered Iran tremendous economic benefits if it halts its nuclear weapons program, but threatened to bomb the hell out of them if it doesn't. Well, he tried that. The White House last week finally gave media outlets a copy of its Memorandum of Understanding, digitally signed between Washington and Tehran. The agreement met with staunch criticism from Israeli and U.S. politicians all across the political spectrum, although some prominent Republicans started backing it as details emerged. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham wrote that it might be beneficial, but others disagreed. Louisiana Republican Senator Bill Cassidy called it the worst foreign policy blunder in decades. He added Ronald Reagan is rolling over in his grave. Iran's nuclear ambitions were not curbed, and they have learned that threatening the Strait of Hormuz works and will undoubtedly leverage it in the future, Cassidy wrote. Now Iran gets to build brand new infrastructure under this deal. Before the war, the strait was open, Iran was being crushed by sanctions, and 13 service members were still alive. Now 13 Americans are dead, families have paid billions at the pump, sanctions will be lifted, and the bombing has stopped. This is the worst foreign policy blunder in decades. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz said, "History demonstrates giving billions of dollars to theocratic lunatics who want to murder us is an exceptionally bad idea. If we give billions of dollars to Iran, that money will be used to murder Americans, and so I don't believe we should do that. The idea that we would have effectively a Marshall Plan for Iran and come in and rebuild Iran after they've been the leading state sponsor of terrorism for 47 years, they've murdered nearly 1,000 Americans, I don't think that makes any sense," Ted Cruz added. Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from the same state, Texas, said Israel seemed to be left out of the deal, which calls for the permanent end to military operations on all fronts, including in Lebanon. "I would encourage them to continue to take the fight to Hezbollah, because unfortunately now Iran is going to have hundreds of millions of dollars to support its terrorist proxies, including Hezbollah," Cornyn said. Yeah, I think that's a mistake. Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker, a member of the Armed Services Committee, said, "I am concerned that the Memorandum of Understanding negotiates away the victories of Operation Epic Fury in ways that are completely out of step with the president's goals." Israel and its supporters continue to be concerned that the memorandum empowers the Islamic Republic, allows for huge economic resources to pour into Iran, is short on details regarding the prevention of a nuclear Iran, fails to mention ballistic missiles, and demands an end to the war in Lebanon. Israel's been under heavy Iranian ballistic missile fire over the last year, first during the 12-day war in June of 2025, and again from February 28th through April 8th, when a shaky ceasefire went into effect. This new memorandum prolongs the ceasefire for 60 days, with the option of a further extension, during which time Washington and Tehran will hold talks to flush out details of the agreement. During the press conference, Trump claims the deal was good for Israel. I told Bibi, your biggest risk was that they drop a nuclear weapon into the middle of Israel. They only need one, and there would be no more Israel. You got the most important thing you were asking for, Trump said. Iran has agreed they will neither produce nor procure, well, he said, or procure nuclear weapons, Trump said, adding Tehran would work with the United States to turn over the enriched uranium at the nuclear sites bombed during the war. Technical discussions on the removal of all stockpiles of enriched materials will begin immediately, Trump added. Mind you, the current Iranian regime, now closing in on 50 years in power, has an elaborate track record of negotiating in bad faith, failing to keep agreements, continuing to pour resources into developing nuclear weapons and ballistic missile delivery systems, even while its own citizens are running out of water, developing and selling elaborate attack drones to Russia, North Korea, and any other regime focused on aggressively hurting its neighboring nations. Iran has developed, funded, and supplied horrific terrorist entities and encouraged them to commit war crimes and attempt genocide. The Iranians to date have never had an international agreement they have kept, because their own version of radical Islam does not see other nations or international organizations or neighbors, or the U.S. certainly, as anything but lesser human beings destined to be conquered or destroyed. So, this memorandum of understanding gives the Iranians a break from war, offers to remove all the economic sanctions imposed because the Iranian regime cheated and lied so many times in the past. Those sanctions have indeed essentially destroyed the Iranian economy and empowered the limited surviving opposition to seek change, only to have this same continuing regime slaughter them, its own citizens, wholesale just a few months ago. And now, the Iranian regime gets to keep its ballistic missiles and maybe eventually, perhaps we hope, downgrade the uranium they have already enriched. Trump defended his position on Iran's retention of ballistic missiles, explaining that Iran had to keep pace with its neighbors. The Iranians have to have some because other people have some, Trump said, adding, am I going to let Saudi Arabia have missiles, but they can't have them? It doesn't work that way. Of course, Iran has attacked nearly all its neighbors in the course of this war, using some of those ballistic missiles. But most of them, of course, it fired towards Israel. President Trump similarly defended the provisions in the agreement that lifted the sanctions, including on the export of oil, and allowed for the creation of a $300 billion fund for rehabilitation and economic development, accessible should a final nuclear deal be arrived at after the 60-day negotiation period. The fund is only if they are doing things right, Trump underscored, adding they have to behave themselves. And when the U.S. president shifts his ever-varying attention to, say, cage fighting on the White House lawn, or using the Justice Department to persecute his critics, or bomb Venezuela, or try to buy Greenland, just who will make certain that this very determined Iranian radical Shia Islam mullah-inspired regime will abide by this agreement? The president also addressed one of the central sticking points of this deal for Israel, the demand for an end to the war in Lebanon. Doing so would leave the Iranian proxy group Hezbollah intact at a time when Israel has been negotiating with Lebanon for a peace deal that would tackle the issue of Hezbollah and its many weapons and its power in the south of Lebanon. In other words, this deal essentially empowers Hezbollah to keep its base in southern Lebanon. In all fairness to Benjamin Netanyahu, who happens to be a very good man, he gets a little excited sometimes, said Trump, explaining that they had a little dispute over Lebanon. Trump said that Lebanese leaders would be visiting the White House soon. He reiterated comments from a couple of days back, criticizing Israeli combat in Lebanon, explaining that Syria would do a better job against Hezbollah. Syria? I'm sorry. The last time Syria went into Lebanon under the murderous regime of Hafez al-Assad, they basically conquered the whole country, murdered 60,000 people, and didn't leave for 30 years, claiming all the time that it was part of Syria. With Iran, Syria was pretty much responsible for the development of Hezbollah into the dangerous terrorist army it constitutes now, stronger than the Lebanese army. In other random thoughts, Trump also said he sought Saudi Arabia's entry into the Abraham Accords, first put in place in 2020, and under whose rubric a number of Arab countries have now normalized ties with Israel. I think Saudi Arabia, if they lead the way, they will be doing themselves a big favor, Trump said. Well, the U.S. entered this war against Iran, according to our president, to destroy Iranian nuclear capability and end its status as the principal sponsor of vicious terrorist regimes all around the Middle East and of terrorism all around the world. America has now spent over $100 billion, 13 Americans have died, and the rest of us Americans have spent many, many billions more on gasoline, food, and all other kinds of items because of the president's incredible miscalculation that Iran had no options in this war. They did. They closed the Strait of Hormuz and caused oil prices to rocket upward. By any standard, this new agreement is fundamentally worse than the Iranian deal Barack Obama made so many years ago, the one that Trump criticized nonstop for all that time. Trump's continued and insane claims that there was some sort of airplane back then that brought $13 billion to Iran as part of the Obama deal pales in comparison to the hundreds of billions of dollars Iran gets out of his agreement. As if that wasn't enough of an admission of the complete failure of this administration's war in Iran, Vice President J.D. Vance attacked anyone in Israel who would dare to criticize this lopsided deal. But this doesn't feel so much like a peace agreement as a surrender by us. We shall see. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Neil Friedman, the founder of Menemsha Films and High Flicks, who is a longtime pro in the movie industry, or as they call it in Southern California, the industry. There are such a range of films and TV series. It seems to me that people are focused to a great deal, much greater extent on streaming TV series than on individual films these days. Is that a fair assessment based on your experience also with Jewish films on HyFlix?
It's a very fair assessment. I will say that one thing, I will say that the primary driver of people to subscribe to HyFlix is TV series, but we have such a plethora of films that we get a large viewing of films as well. What we've done, Rabbi, is we have made a deal, what we call an output deal, with 12 other U.S. distributors for all their Jewish films. So there is a large quantity of Jewish-themed films on HyFlix. It's not, Menemsha is a small part of the Jewish films available on HyFlix. So we really have a great diversity of films. And, you know, it's a question of subscriber to HyFlix is someone who's interested in Jewish cultural history. And it could come out of viewing a TV series, either from Israel or Argentina or from Switzerland. We have series from all over the world, or film. I think of ourselves as entertainment and educational at the same time, which it gives us a cultural responsibility and makes us feel that we're educating and bringing together disparate parts of the Jewish community in a community sense, that they're watching and seeing films and TV series that they otherwise would not have access to with this once streaming service that we created in 2019.
You know, you mentioned earlier with Medemsha, you had success. You had $1 million on a film. You used to work for TriStar. $1 million was probably the catering budget on some of those films. It's a different kind of market, the Jewish market. Can you explore that a little bit?
Well, it's a great, you hit it right nail on the head there. It's a niche market. And I like that because instead of looking for as among 4,000 films, I can choose from among 250. But I was a major in college, believe it or not, in Jewish studies and film.
Ah.
So I'm really doing the same thing that I did when I was 19, 20, and 21 years old. And I've always had an interest in this area. And there are enough Jewish films, Jewish-themed films, to have a business and to have a six-and-a-half-day week of work to find the right films. And I find it much more satisfactory to work in this small niche. Now, the niche is so small that basically we're the only ones in this niche.
Well, you have kind of a monopoly on the niche, if you will.
Yeah, I like monopoly as a game. I'm not like monopoly as a word, especially as an antitrust lawyer. But
yes, indeed.
We've been doing it since 2003, and you may know this, but I want to share with your audience. There's 150 Jewish film festivals in North America, and we've been the leading supplier of Jewish films to those Jewish film festivals since 2003. So that is an existing market. Even though it's a niche, there's something unique about this niche with those 150 Jewish film festivals that is specific to Jewish. Extraordinary. And people that, you know, come year after year to these Jewish film festivals, and it's like they want to see everything. And it's a community event in these, you know, whether it's in New York City or in a small town, you know, Memphis, Tennessee, or Stowe, Vermont.
Or Tucson, Arizona, where the Jewish Film Festival is a big deal
exactly.
Every year, everywhere.
Exactly. And I'm glad you reminded me of that, because we do have a great relationship with the Tucson Jewish Film Festival and have for many years.
Pleased to know that, and I actually kind of knew that, but never mind. and it's an important part of the communal life and the cultural life. In most places that have a Jewish film festival. You mentioned, I don't want to focus too much on streaming series because there's so many interesting films available. You mentioned streaming series, though, coming from Argentina. Jewish films come from everywhere in the diaspora. What's a region that we wouldn't think of that produces some really fine films these days?
Well, the easy answer is France. The harder answer is Argentina. Actually, because obviously there are 250,000 Jews in Argentina. Maybe there's 200 now with the migration to Israel. But over the years, we've probably released 12 to 15 Argentinian Jewish titles, which may not come to the mind of the folks that are listening to your podcast. France is obviously a big cinema country, and I just came back from Cannes, and thank God. This year I'm interested in more of the French films than normal because the French are producing this year a higher percentage of the overall available Jewish themed films that are available for me to acquire and distribute in the United States. And that may be something to do with the tenor of the times, obviously, and it could be just temporary, but it may be part of a trend that now that we're in this very anti-Semitic phase of the world. Obviously, the Israelis are producing less films and less TV series, and that's a shame because the Israelis, especially in the TV side of things.
The quality of the Israeli TV shows has been exceptional.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And they've changed the face of the television business, Rabbi, because they did something that's unique in the sense that they really started to license what they call formats. So you'd have a film like In Therapy, In Treatment, actually.
Right.
That's been licensed for in format to France and, you know, in other places around the world. So that is what they're very, very good at, is not only selling the Hebrew version of the Israeli show, but having their concept remade in different countries around the world.
It was successful here. I think Gabriel Byrne played the lead in an English language version here. What's your favorite new film that you've seen recently?
I would say it's a Israeli film that I saw at Berlin called Where To, Berlin Film Festival. It's an independent film by an Israeli living in Berlin. It's a story about a Palestinian cab driver who befriends a Israeli passenger, and they really become more than just people that talk to each other, but they really share their personal lives with each other. And it's just refreshing and hopeful to see something like that. It's very genuine, and it gives you some hope. And that's what we need these days as part of the world that is in crisis. We had a big hit last year, Rabbi, with Bad Shabbos.
Yeah. That's a hysterical film, by the way.
Yeah.
And love that movie.
That was a great, great success for us. We hoped to do $1 million, and we did $1.5 million, which is upside surprise. And that rarely happens for us.
A lot of great Jewish documentaries have been produced. How much nonfiction material? I mean, you must have to limit what you make available. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it's a good question, because now, because of there's been more documentaries being made on Jewish subjects because of the cost being less, and obviously you're not filming, you're using archival footage much more, and you're interviewing
much less expensive, much more available, and of course important subjects.
Yes, so my job is to find as many narrative films, meaning fiction, as possible for the Jewish film festivals. We always want to have narrative films because those are the films, like Bad Shabbos, that drive people to go to the film festivals, because they sometimes think of documentaries as something they could see on TV, which, you know, is not necessarily the case. But to get people out of the house, you know, having a film like Where To or Bad Shabbos and other films that we've released over the years that have been, you know, surprising hits for us. We've had 8 films that have done over $1 million, which is pretty great. That's what film festivals rely on us to supply or make available to them.
Neil, where can people go to find out more about both Menemsha Films and High Flix and sign up on High Flix? I think you guys have a free trial offer. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, High Flix is, we have, you know, there's 2 different websites. For Menemsha, it's www.menemshafilms.com and HyFlix. And by the way, we couldn't get FLIX like Netflix, but we got, so it's www.chaiflix.com. And the journalists have been very kind to us, Rabbi. They refer to us as the Jewish Netflix. And I like that term, because that's what we're increasing the availability of films, shorts, and TV series all the time on HyFlix. So it becomes almost a library for people, or an archive for people to go to and always have new programs to view.
I think it's a great platform, and I was going to call it the circumcised Netflix, but that seems inappropriate. Neil, thank you so much. I highly recommend it.
Pleasure.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Tracy Kaplowitz, coordinator of the recent Recharging Reform Judaism Conference held in New York. And join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night. Services in Onik Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush live in person and on our Facebook page. All led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org for more information, our service and class schedule, to sign up for our new Torah Tykes membership. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes for Father's Day today. It's from Barbra Streisand, the semi-classic film Yentl. It's called Papa, Can You Hear Me? My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you see me? Papa, can you find me? Please forgive me, try to understand.